Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and we try to do this pretty much every day. We don't always succeed, but we always try to get the most interesting guests, and today is no exception. We're joined by Eli Lake, who is a columnist for Bloomberg, and, well, you've been around, Eli. You've been with, the Daily Beast and Newsweek?
That's right. I was at one point a contributing editor at the New Republic. I wrote for the Washington Times, and I have a long history with the New York Sun. Seth Lipsky, one of my mentors, and I was his last Washington bureau chief when he was the editor of the Forward many years ago.
Well, okay. So you are an experienced writer, wordsmith, and so I of course want to ask you about Jeff Bezos and his remarkable Medium piece last week, which was, I'm still trying to get my head around the whole idea that we're talking about David Pecker and dick pics and billionaires and sextortion. And it just seems so 2019. It seems like this is the world that we deserve, doesn't it? So what did you think of him writing that piece on Medium?
Stick to, as a writer, I thought, you know, he used this word complexify, which is just terrible. You don't have to create an idiom, you know, you can say make more complicated, but I'm nitpicking. I thought generally, I think it's great when someone who is being extorted, quite stupidly by a lawyer who is, I guess, currently, you know, working with the Justice Department on an investigation having to do with Saudi Arabia, saying, you know what, you don't extort me, I expose you. And I thought that was I admire that spirit, because yeah. nobody likes a blackmailer, you know?
Well, no, and you pointed out on Twitter that he was kind of a clunky writer, but I don't want to keep using all these anatomical references, but it was an incredibly ballsy move to push back on all of that. You know, I always try to put myself in the other guy's position, and I'm thinking, you know, this was awful. This was terrible. I would like to shame them, but you know what? I'm not going for talking about dick pics. I'm not doing it. And so that was what was sort of kind of refreshing. It was like, okay, you know what? You've got nothing on me. I am not going to be shamed. I'm not going to be embarrassed. And I'm going to turn this around on you. So,
I mean, the one thing I would say is that we have no idea. There has been no proof that has been given from the sort of speculation that there was some role of a government agency that would have accessed his text. So that is sort of hanging out there in, you know, a state of suspended speculation, I guess. But
if that's true.
That is a remarkable abuse of power. If it had anything to do, if there's any chain that leads to the president, at this point, we are not even close to knowing if that's true. There are other explanations here of how the National Enquirer and their parent company would have gotten hold of the aforementioned pictures and texts. But that said, I mean, I'm just saying that this could turn into a very important story about abuse of power. Right now, I don't think that we're even close to it. But regardless, the practice that we've also read about before when it comes from the National Enquirer of pay to slay it might be legal, but, it's barely legal, I guess. It's forget legality. It's, in my view, deeply unethical. And it's nice to have, you know, it's nice when you have a moment, I guess, where someone pushes back against it, and hopefully, you know, people who are prone to do that kind of thing would learn that it doesn't always work, and you can be hoisted on your own petard.
You mentioned if it was a government agency, what an abuse it would be, it certainly would be. And of course, there's also that suggestion out there that are we dealing with possibly, you know, foreign, collusion with the Saudi Arabians? I mean, how ironic would it be if Donald Trump did not collude with the Russians, but was caught colluding on something like this with the Saudi Arabians? But as you point out, we are a long way away from that.
We don't have no. Yeah. Evidence of that. I don't quite understand the theory of how it was like the Saudis, other than to say that it is well known that not just Saudi Arabia, but lots of countries, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Russia, you know, have resorted to kind of hacking individuals, or hiring hackers or hiring firms that do this kind of stuff, and then trying to get it out there into the press and the public conversation. That's been done before. We saw that actually with Elliot Brady, who is not mm-hmm. terribly sympathetic mm-hmm. with the Democrats, but we also saw it with, of course, John Podesta, who, is at the center of the original scandal having to do with, the hacking in 2016 and Russian influence of the election. So in my view, there's another element of this, which is that if the Saudis, we don't know. So I'm going to make it very clear.
Right.
We don't have facts right now, but that there is this, I have written about this now for a while, but there's a new threat to our privacy, and it's foreign governments. It's not, it used to be, I would say the 20th century view of digital privacy was that we had to fear the NSA, the mm-hmm. Big Brother model. And now what we have is a Hobbesian world, a Hobbesian war against our digital privacy, which is that there are all kinds of actors, some state actors, some non-state actors, who can easily kind of get learn about our online lives and then, kind of make them public in a flash.
This also raises the role of, compromat that we've been throwing around, that this problem might be broader, with more players than we had suspected. And anyone who is rich and powerful and becomes a target like this, the possibility that there is this kind of information and that it would be used to extort or blackmail becomes a non-trivial problem.
Well, okay, and I agree with you kind of in the hypothetical. If you're getting into Trump, though, maybe it would be like a nice moment maybe to sort of, get into this conversation because, I like to consider myself a pretty hardcore Russia hawk. I mean, if you just mm-hmm. read my columns. And I was one of the, I think, first columnists to write about, the Russian hacking in 2016 and pinning it on the Russians. And, when Trump said things like, it could be a fat guy in, a bathtub or something like that, I forget the exact line. I mean, that was absurd and crazy. But that said, I have to say that there's a version of this argument that sometimes sort of then says, the Russians have stuff on him,
mm-hmm.
Therefore he has been doing the bidding of the Kremlin as president. I don't think that the 2 years of his foreign policy bear that out. And I think that's a very weak case at this point. And I think that those who kind of shout it the loudest, are discrediting what in my view are legitimate lines of inquiry into the president at this point. So I'll put that on the table.
I'm perhaps not one of those that shout out the loudest, but this is the question that hangs at the back of my mind. And I do understand that you need to separate out the administration's Russia policy from the president's odd deference to Vladimir Putin. It seems that his unwillingness to criticize him, his fawning servility to Putin, and the contrast to the treatment of virtually everyone else. So, I mean, that's what I have in the back of my mind, and I agree with you. You could certainly, if you go through the U.S. policy to Russia, and I want to ask you about that in just a moment. He's been pretty, he's obviously been pretty strong. However, there does seem to be some reluctance or some fascination that he has with the person of Vladimir Putin. And that's where in the back of my mind I'm going, this is not a rational player here. I mean, there's some element that's missing. Now, maybe it's just, that he admires the macho celebrity, unaccountable power of Vladimir Putin or something else. But this is why someone like me would not. I'm not going for the P tape here. But it's like, what is going on there?
All right. So you raise a good point, and I think it's important to criticize Trump's performance in Helsinki and other moments where he has inexplicably, compared. I mean, he's inexplicably said things and flattered Putin in ways that are awful. He's done the same thing with Kim Jong-un, with regards to this true nuclear deal. And this is, I can explain some of that. In that Trump believes, which some people like Henry Kissinger also believe, that It's in America's interest to have a good relationship with the authoritarian despot that sits atop Russia, Vladimir Putin, because we can work together against, jihadists, and we can cause the wedge with Iran and China. And there is an argument, which I actually dispute mm-hmm. and think is wrong, but that on realpolitik grounds. And then you add to that Trump's personality, which is somebody who does not care to learn the details of foreign policy, has at best a casual, if not antagonistic, relationship to the truth, likes to sort of make up narratives and just claim and believe them. And you can see that this is a sort of toxic brew of the president, interacting and saying things about the leader of Russia, who is a real adversary, that are totally out of any kind of conversation. But I guess I would point out that the strong policies against Russia cannot be entirely ascribed to accident. The people at the top of the CIA, Gina Haspel, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, and until, he left, Jim Mattis, are all appointed and nominated by Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
He does not have a grasp of every detail of our Russia policy, but on big decisions, he eventually does sign off. And the most recent one is what I think is the admirable set of decisions that the White House and Trump made with regards to the illegitimacy of the Nicolas Maduro regime in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. That is a direct shot across the bow to the Russians, who not only invested a lot in Venezuela, but they sent their warships to, dock there. In many ways, Maduro, for all of his anti-imperialist socialist nonsense rhetoric, allowed for, China, Russia, and Cuba to be these kind of rapacious imperial powers in, resource-rich Venezuela. So for the United States not only to recognize Juan Guaido as the president of the National Assembly as the real interim leader of Venezuela, but to help coordinate a global effort to recognize him, where now you have most of Europe, most of the Western Hemisphere, all saying Maduro is not a legitimate president of Venezuela, is an enormous blow to Russia, as is, and I can give you other examples, but
and a rather impressive display of multilateralism. There was a question of, is multilateralism going to survive Trump? And this seems to be a very, very successful multilateral initiative on their part.
I mean, let me put it like this. I can understand why, the Democratic Socialists of America, which are, basically useful idiots for, Castro and Maduro and every other dirtbag tyrant in for the most part, are opposing Trump. I mean, that sort of follows. But, I don't think most Democrats have or should dispute this approach. So far, so good. We can see what happens. I mean, people can second guess. Well, I don't know if we don't know if Maduro will leave power at this point. We don't know how much of the military is affected, even though we've seen some good signs. But, so that's an example. So I'm just saying these are going to get back to the Russia point.
Yeah.
There are a number of these examples. I believe, contrary to, some people I respect, that withdrawing from the INF Treaty is not good for Russia, because it was beneficial to them to have the United States in an arms control treaty, which it was not abiding by, but the U.S. was. I believe selling arms, defensive weapons to Ukraine, something that Obama wouldn't do, is not good for Russia. I would say that shutting down consulate in San Francisco was a major blow to the Russians, and actually the diplomatic facilities that that Trump shuttered were more significant than the ones that Obama shuttered at the sort of end of his presidency. And there's a series of these kinds of things. Is it perfect? No. I mean, I think that I wrote about this. I have a lot of problems with the deal that they gave to Deripaska's aluminum company.
Okay, I was going to ask about Deripaska and about Syria. So.
Syria, I disagree with, although to claim that the United States was in Syria to counter Russia is false. Mm-hmm. We do know that under Trump, there was a confrontation with Russian mercenaries. And when they engaged U.S. forces blew them, to smithereens. And also, unlike Obama, you know, Trump twice fired Tomahawk missiles into, you know, largely kind of what used to be called back in the 90s, cruise missile diplomacy. But nonetheless, he did attack Putin's important client, Bashar al-Assad's regime, which is something yes. that a line that Obama famously drew and would not enforce.
Okay. What about Deripaska though? And because I know that you wrote about this when the Senate had a vote, right. and you were disappointed that Mitt Romney had gone along with that. So,
correct.
But that seemed, the timing of that seemed really. I mean, that raised a lot of eyebrows with all of the focus on Trump Russia relations to lift the sanctions, to accept basically a fig leaf on one of the major players in all of this.
Okay. So my view is that it is a fig leaf and that it's a deal that's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to enforce. And given the previous experience we had with Trump undermining his own Commerce Department with sanctions against VTE, the Chinese mm-hmm. telecom, during that, we can't count on Trump to enforce the sanctions if and when Deripaska violates their terms. Okay, so that's a very important thing. That said, if you talk to the Treasury Department, there are policy reasons, and there are, you know, I'm just saying, like, policy wonks who do sanctions for a living, who were, you know, worked for Obama but are not, you know, these are not, like, Republican cutouts, who would take the other view that the original sanctions did not really account for the impact on the aluminum industry, and that, you know, that there are national interest reasons as to why, and this was a good deal in the sense that, you know, assuming again it's enforceable, which is where my objection is, that mm-hmm. Deripaska divested himself from these companies in such a way that he was no longer controlling them. I guess what I would say to this is that I think it's bad policy. I do not think that it is such an egregious collapse that it is evidence of something much worse. Whereas if you saw an abrupt change in policy that said the United States recognizes Russian claims to Crimea and the faux referendum in yeah. Crimea that made them part of Russia, or if you saw the full-scale sort of removal of all sanctions on Russia related to their incursion in 2014 into Ukraine, those are things where I'd be like, wait a second, what the heck is going on? As it stands, the envoy to the Minsk process on Ukraine is a guy named Kurt Volker, who is, you know, a McCain guy who, you know, if you look at his writings when he was out of government, is the opposite of what you would expect in a kind of Trumpian foreign policy, if there is such a thing. So there are a lot of examples. If you just listen to, like, Mike Pompeo talk about Russia, you're not hearing, you know, I mean, you would think that if the Russians had real compromise on Trump, they would want a more pliable Secretary of State. I was and let mm-hmm. me say one more thing, and then I'll we can go.
Sure.
I think it's completely given in 2016, after he wins the election, it is reasonable. In fact, it's the only intelligent position is to ask, what the heck is going to happen? This guy, the candidate who won the election, said things about Russia that are insane. That are just what is going to happen now? That is a completely reasonable question in 2016. With the benefit of 2 years of the Trump administration at this point, we have to always remember that the president has enormous powers and can decide, you know, to change things rather quickly with very little input from Congress. But that said, up to now, we have not seen any kind of evidence of the quo for the quid, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a very, very powerful case. And you also point out that these leading, the people who are, you know, shaping the foreign policy, which is not as radical a departure as perhaps some people had thought or feared that it would be, you know, that they were all appointed by the president. But I think late last week, we crossed the 50-day, you know, anniversary, if there's a misusing word, of course, of the resignation of Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense. So talk about how the significance of that and what's changed since that, because if, in fact, your hope, which I hope you're right, you know, the hope is that, you know, that these grown-ups in the room, to use that cliche, you know, are going to, you know, keep steering the Trump administration in the right direction. Jim Mattis's recognition, I mean, his resignation was a potential turning point, wasn't it? I mean, that really was a red flag.
I agree with you, especially because the letter that he wrote talked about questions of values and valuing our alliances. So for me, you know, I agree with you that, you know, the resignation of Jim Mattis was, you know, it was a very low moment for the administration. A couple things have happened in those 50 days. One, the withdrawal from Syria is much less at this point than Trump made it seem in his series of tweets and in that week when Mattis resigned. For one, if you just look at the latest testimony this week from General Votel, who is in charge of Central Command, what he says is there is no real timeline and it's not really conditions-based, and it made it seem like there wasn't going to be this sort of rapid withdrawal. It looks at this point that the U.S. is going to stay in a base known as Tomp, which is a very important place to watch the Iranians as well as ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And then add to this, you know, you have leaders of the Syrian, you know, various Syrian Kurdish groups that fought bravely against ISIS with U.S. special operators. You know, I was worried that there would be a, you know, that the Turks were threatening an incursion into Syria to wipe out our allies, which is terrible, not just on humanitarian grounds, but it really does. That's a body blow. It's almost a knockout punch to American credibility.
And that seemed probable at that time.
It did seem probable. And so the idea that in the face of that pressure, the United States was going to just leave and let our allies who were fighting with us, our mutual enemies in ISIS, so they're fighting for us in a lot of ways. It's always something to remember that. You know, we would just let them to be slaughtered. That to me was, you know, reminiscent of, you know, a Democratic controlled Congress in 1975 voting to completely cut off South Vietnam, basically setting up, you know, the rampage of the NVA that year. So I thought I was preparing for the worst. And in the interim, there has been diplomacy with Ankara. The Turks have backed off. You know, there was a tweet that I think a lot of people should have read around that time where I think Trump said, I will devastate the Turkey's economy if they touch, you know, they follow through on this thing to the Kurds. But I think there were serious threats that were made privately as well. And that so far, this has not happened. And the Kurds themselves have said in interviews that they are not worried at this point about, you know, that could happen. Now, it could happen, and if it does, and we should try to prevent that from happening. But so far, that hasn't happened either.
Well,
those are factors that I'm not saying it's not that we should get out of Syria, by the way.
No.
It doesn't make it okay, but it makes it less horrendous than before.
Well, let's break down because, on the Syria policy, the end product is one thing, what the policy is going to be. But then there was also, and this came up again this last week, was the you know, the process by which that decision was made, and the generals testified, if I got this correctly, that no, they had not been consulted at all before the decision was made. It's unclear how the decision was, you know, what advice the president took. So I guess the question is that sort of, are you concerned at all about, are you alarmed at all about the decision, the president's rather capricious decision-making process, that yes, at a certain, he will do something, you know, announce a policy via Twitter, then he will walk it back, you know, calmer heads will prevail, but it seems always precarious in that sense, you know, and particularly with the resignation of General Mattis, you have one more voice removed from the room, and yes, in this case, we did not get the worst case scenario. But for the president of the United States to announce a policy with those many that with you know such consequential policy without consulting the people on the ground, I mean, in itself, doesn't that raise your concerns about some of all these other issues that we're dealing with?
All right. So I'm just asking.
It's the right
question, and of course, we want the government to run smoothly and so forth. But sometimes this point can be a little emphasized. I want to say two things that I think mitigate this. the president has made no secret publicly, and I understand privately, he has said from the very beginning he doesn't like the idea of the U.S. in Afghanistan or Syria. So the particular contours of the particular contours of, like, when he made the announcement, which was, I agree with you, the rollout and the way he did it, we knew it was pretty awful. Everybody was kind of surprised, and it's important that, you know, that that's not done that way. But on the other hand, everybody kind of knew this was coming. I mean, he had sort of said from the beginning of his presidency that he didn't necessarily want to be in these kinds of wars, and I think that he'd asked for options. And one of the reasons why Mattis left is because, you know, I think that Trump was frustrated that he didn't feel like he had good options to do the kinds of things he wanted to, which is to largely withdraw U.S. forces on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the other point I would just make is that, like, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to lean too hard into the position of foreign policy should only be done by the permanent government or the experts. Okay, because they also get stuff wrong. Everybody talks about the Iraq War. I'm not going to talk about the Iraq War because I disagree with the consensus on the Iraq War as it is. But I'm just saying there's a lot of examples where our best agencies, like the CIA before, now we're on the 40th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution, but in like the months before, there's a famous sort of assessment where they said Iran is not in a pre-revolutionary state. You know, there's all kinds of things that foreign policy experts, and then there's another really strong argument that we live in a republic. And in our republic, we elect a we entrust with making foreign policy, and part of this is when he tells us what he wants to do. And one of the things that Trump did on the campaign trail is he said, I want to get out of Afghanistan. It was a dumb war. You know, he says it over and over again. So that's what he won the election. He has a right to do that. And I have a problem with, you know, slowing that decision down. I mean, the president should be able to change his mind if he gets more facts. That's certainly true. And that's okay as well. But I just am saying that, like, the idea that we sort of say, well, you know, Trump doesn't listen to any of the experts. Well, you know, he's the president. He has the constitutional authority here. And there are other experts who also agree with him. So we should just, you know, that's my word of
Well, thought. Okay. I mean, but you know, the stakes can be very, very large here if in fact, you have a president who is not listening to these people. And obviously, the experts, you know, are wrong, and there's a long history of it. But we're coming up on another summit with North Korea, and stakes could be very, very high with this North Korean summit. And the president last time sort of famously said he was not going to do much preparation because, you know, he was going to follow his gut. And he clearly has a great deal of confidence in the North Korean in the North Korean leader. So tell me about this
trouble
one.
Ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So that you're a little
trouble
worried
ahead.
About this. One. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I just
what are you worried about with the North Korean summit? What do you see
I'm
coming?
Just worried about, I don't understand. I mean, I hate the idea that the president of the United States, the world's oldest democratic country in the world, you know, I mean, it just is conferring legitimacy on, you know, the warden of a slave state. I mean, I just hate it. And so there's so just on a values point, all of this stuff about, oh, he's a bright young man and he's a great leader and his people love him. It's just that just nauseates me. Then there's the history of the North Koreans. They lie all the time. They never keep their word. We've gone down this road many times. And then, you know, the admirable sort of hard line that they took after even the Singapore summit, which is that we don't begin lifting any sanctions until we get denuclearization, as they say, has already started to soften. If you look at the envoy to North Korea, Steve Biegun, recently gave a speech last week in which he kind of began to walk that back as a policy matter. And yeah, my sources sort of tell me that, you know, you can start seeing what the North Koreans want, which is that we do a little bit of, you know, we dismantle a little bit here and then you do some more there. And then he starts to change the atmosphere in general, because if there is any kind of declaration of peaceful intent, which they've done these kinds of things before, that has a kind of effect of maybe softening the environment for enforcing the sanctions that already exist. So the idea that we wanted to strangle, you know, what's left of the North Korean economy, which in some ways is not just a sort of way to get them to change their behavior, which, by the way, I don't think that any sanctions would get them to change their behavior, but it's also a way to cut off revenue so they can't complete, you know, and perfect an intercontinental ballistic missile to deliver their nuclear weapons. that I think is sort of out the door. So I think that the North Koreans are going to play us again and play for time, and then they're going to have a, be able to kind of create a crisis again of their own choosing, and this thing's really going to blow up in Trump's face. And maybe it won't blow up in Trump's face. Maybe the next president will have to deal with this problem, but he is not going to get what they wanted, which is a verifiable, you know, comprehensive disarmament of their nuclear program. We're not, I don't think there's any chance we get that, and I'm not the only one. The leaders of the U.S. intelligence community agree.
So let's talk about the Saudi Arabians. I've lost track of how long it's been now with Jamal Khashoggi, but it seems pretty clear that the Saudis have gotten away with the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that the president has made a real politique judgment that he wants to stay friendly with the Saudi leaders.
I don't know if I think they necessarily got away with it. I mean, in the sense that I think they've paid a price.
Mohammed bin Salman is still in power and doesn't seem to have.
Okay, fine. Mohammed bin Salman is still in power. All right. But I'm saying that do you think that other American allies, autocratic allies of the United States, are like, you know what? That MDS man, you know, I'm going to start murdering journalists who I don't like. Okay. I mean, I think that they would look at it and say, this was a massive excrement show for U.S.-Saudi relations for 2 months. There are now Magnitsky Act sanctions on senior Saudi officials. They have been humiliated and embarrassed. There's a resolution blaming the sovereign of Saudi Arabia, MBS, unanimously passed in the U.S. Senate. So the U.S.-Saudi relationship has not ended, and I don't know many people who, if they give it some more thought, would agree to that. But, you know, MBS, and I don't know that the really dramatic decision that we're just not going to have the same relationship. We're no longer going to consider them allies. You know,
right.
I don't think we have the ability, I guess, to say, to affect regime change in Saudi Arabia. The time, the crown prince, and we could have used certain influence to say, we think that Mohammed bin Salman is the wrong choice to be the successor, and you should choose someone else. And that may have worked. Or may not have worked, but that was the time to do that. Once that decision is made, I don't know that we have the ability to do that short of threatening and then having to really follow through on the threat of ending the relationship as we know it. And again, if somebody wants to argue for ending the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and believe me, in the last 20 years, there have been moments where I have come very close to that. Let's have that argument. But that's a very different discussion than, you know, at that point, then what you're haggling over the price that MBS should pay. Because at this point, I don't think there's an option to keep that Saudi relationship and then regime change with MBS.
No, you make a very good case. The price would be very, very high. When I say they got away with it, it's just that, you know, it seems extremely likely that MBS, you know, ordered the murder of a U.S. resident and a journalist. And certainly he has not been held accountable the way that most murderers would be. But you're right. I mean, you know, short of regime change, what would you do? Do you have any sense of where we're going on the U.S.-China trade negotiations? Because the stakes, are incredibly high. The deadline is looming for those tariffs, and the market's going to watch that very, very nervously. Are they going to come up with that?
The tariffs, I don't really know where it is, and I'm not a trade guy. Right. I mean, I can write a little bit about trade, but it's not my thing. But I would say that on the issue of Huawei, which is the massive Chinese telecom, which is basically an arm of their intelligence service, or the equivalent of their NSA, the Trump administration has gone further than, Bush or Obama and this has been an issue for a long time, in trying to get our allies to not build their 5G networks using Huawei equipment because they believe that it's bugged. There is, from my perspective, as somebody who's been a longtime intelligence reporter, a kind of delicious irony here is that one of the reasons that America is so attuned to why a national telecom company can be a valuable asset if they build, you know, various telecom wires and, you know, kind of antennas and stations throughout the world. It's because for years the U.S. had a great advantage, or the NSA had a great advantage because, you know, AT&T built a lot of the 20th century telecommunication networks in the world, and also later in the fiber optic networks, because they all go through the United States. And, so when Huawei is building cell towers in Norway or, Bangladesh, it's like that old commercial, like, where did you learn to use drugs? From you, Dad, from watching you.
Exactly. No, that is pretty good. Eli, thanks so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be on the show,
and I'm so
glad.
It has been great. Yeah.
Can we have a moment just at the end here, if
sure.
I could just say, I tweet a lot about this, and I, many years ago wrote for the Weekly Standard, and it was really sad to see it go.
It really is a loss, and I feel it every day. I would like to describe it as a tragedy, but I think it was something worse than that. And it's I was saying that what we're doing at the Bulwark is not to replace the Weekly Standard. We aren't. The Weekly Standard is like a yacht. We are like Somali pirates. But I certainly miss that publication.
I love the Bulwark, though. No, wait a second. I don't want to, I agree. The Weekly Standard to me is a wonderful institution, and I hate the fact that it doesn't exist, and I think it's more than a tragedy. It's like a crime that it went down that way. But don't sell the Bulwark short. I read it every day.
I'm not dissing Somali pirates. I like being a Somali pirate. Yeah, you can do a lot of damage. You can do a lot of damage with some dangerous guys in dinghies.
Yeah,
underestimate that. Eli, thanks so much. Eli, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.